I will briefly describe how traditional land use assessments are being used as consultation with First Nations in Alberta regarding the impact of proposed industrial development on treaty rights. This is based on working for First Nations for the past 8 years as a traditional land use consultant. But I just want to quickly clarify something before I begin. I'm a graduate student here at McGill, and I'm from Alberta, and thank you, and I've been to the oil sands, I've seen the SAGD operations, and my name is Janelle, not Zoe. So, I'd like to just start with some basics about Aboriginal rights in Canada, because I feel like the average Canadian doesn't know the basics. So the government of Canada has a definition of Aboriginal. I've noticed in this conference that the terms have been sort of thrown around, Indigenous, Aboriginal, First Nations. But according to the Canadian government, an Aboriginal person is First Nations, Métis, or Inuit. And most First Nations people we think of as being legal or status Indians, but in fact, less than 50% are status. So in the Alberta context, this means that it's only people who are treaty who are being consulted, who are legal Indians. And in Treaty 8, those are Cree, Dene, and Métis people. They're not technically status, but they prefer to be called by their name and their group, so Cree, Dene, or Métis. So Treaty 8 is the treaty that covers the oil sands region. And I would just like to quickly read to you the part of the treaty that pertains to traditional land use. And Her Majesty the Queen hereby agrees with the said Indians that they shall have the right to pursue their usual vocations of hunting, trapping, and fishing throughout the tracts surrendered as heretofore described, subject to such regulations as may from time to time be made by the government of the country acting under the authority of Her Majesty and saving and accepting such tracts as may be required or taken up from time to time for settlement, mining, lumbering, trading, or other purposes. What is unique about Treaty 8? Treaty 8 was signed because Canada wanted to ensure access to minerals. The other numbered treaties in the province were signed because there was because of the settlement of westward expansion of people and the railway. So in the north, you know, people never thought that anyone would move or there'd be any activity up there. So, the commissioners, as a part of Treaty 8, the commissioners have a letter that's attached to it. I encourage everyone here to read it. I'm just going to talk about a couple little pieces of it. But they said the country along the Athabasca River is well wooded and there are miles of tar-saturated banks. But as far as our restricted view of the Lake Athabasca and Slave River country enabled us to judge its wealth, apart from its possible mineral developments, consists exclusively in its fisheries and furs. I would say that still the average Albertan thinks of northern Alberta as the subarctic, as a sort of wasteland, you know, that there's no one there and there's nothing of value. But the First Nations were led to believe that they would be able to continue to live off their traditional and familial territories. Therefore, reserves are very small. So again, the commissioner said the main demand will be for ammunition and twine, as the great majority of the Indians will continue to hunt and fish for a livelihood. It does not appear likely that the conditions of the country on either side of the Athabasca and Slave Rivers or about Athabasca Lake will be so changed as to affect hunting or trapping. And it is safe to say that so long as the fur-bearing animals remain, the great bulk of the Indians will continue to hunt and trap. Our chief difficulty was the apprehension that the hunting and fishing privileges were to be curtailed. We assured them that the treaty would not lead to any forced interference with their mode of life. Again, I strongly encourage anyone that's interested in this topic to read the commissioner's letters that are attached to Treaty 8. There's a lot more statements just like this. So there's a series, actually I'd just like to say that people in Treaty 8 do continue to live off the land and speak their language, regardless of sort of myths of assimilation in Canada. And there have been a series of court cases, with the last three of these, the Supreme Court establishing the duty of the Crown to consult First Nations. And Catherine talked about this yesterday, so I'm going to leave it at this. I had a Mac presentation, so apparently it didn't translate well. But so So the province of Alberta has come up with a series of consultation guidelines. The first one that we can't really see was in 2007, and all three of the numbered treaties chiefs officially rejected the consultation guidelines, ironically because they weren't consulted about the development of the consultation guidelines. So there are some more detailed guidelines that have been developed, the 2011 ones, which is the framework that I've been working in. These are the guidelines that show that the province, in place of the Crown, determines which First Nations will be consulted. They pass the duty to consult to the third party, which is industry, who then pays for the consultation and produces a report as a part of their environmental impact assessment, and then the province decides whether or not consultation has been adequate. There's been a new set of consultation guidelines produced recently. They don't really say anything. They acknowledge the duty to consult, and we're sort of waiting to see what's going to happen because they're very ambiguous. So in practice, the province acts as a broker rather than the protector of treaty rights. Because we're talking about treaty rights, we're only looking at Crown land. We're only looking at traditional land use that's on Crown land. And so as a part of this process with environmental impact assessments, First Nations have been bombarded with companies wanting to consult them. So they have offices, which is why I've been working, is that they're so busy that they've been taking in extra support. Now, the companies also hire consultants that facilitate the traditional land use and sometimes go out on the land and manage the reports. These people are consistently untrained. Most of them have never been to reserve. They don't speak the language. Usually they're not even educated in anything related to it. And there's a really fast turnover with those people. So we're constantly having the same conversation and educating them about their own jobs. What happens with the traditional land use assessments is that often there's elders' interviews and land-based assessments. So we go out on the land, we ask elders about their concerns, they show us about the traditional land use, they teach us about traditional knowledge. We produce some maps, or record sites that they'd like to protect, general concerns, observations about climate change, spiritual sites, grave sites. And we also, I always make sure that the elders have a chance to do last-minute harvesting in areas that are going to be destroyed, so they can pick medicines and berries before they're gone. Just a couple of pictures. I'm going quickly. So what's the good of the traditional land use assessment process and the consultation? Well, first of all, there is a transfer of knowledge. Like, outside of all of the reports and the consultation, we've got elders and young people going on the land talking about historic sites and their traditions and speaking the language. We also, if you saw one of these pictures, while we're out on the land, we happen to catch a whole bunch of other companies who haven't consulted the First Nations. So we've found like illegal campsites. This is the Enbridge pipeline that's going in. We were following a historic trail and came across this. There's actually an archaeological site on the lake where the guys are in the background, and they're measuring the distance from the Enbridge pipeline to the lake, and there's actually an infraction. So it was just a total aside from what we were doing. But we find things like this all the time. Another good thing about the traditional land use assessment is that there is some kind of conversation happening. It wasn't very long ago that no one was listening to First Nations at all. We also are recording their concerns, knowledge from the elders, you know, observations. We can actually start to get a baseline of change. And so I often think of my job as being sort of preparing for court cases, you know, where I'm taking notes to be ready to someday go to court. There's also some positive job creation. People are actually getting jobs in something that matters to them. Training and education usually comes with it, and elders are being acknowledged and paid for their worth and knowledge. So some of the bad things about traditional land use assessment is that they're supposed to be timely. According to the guidelines, they're timely, but what typically happens is the environmental impact assessment research is complete before they even talk to the First Nation, and so then there's a pressure to do what they call a rapid assessment before the development begins, and so there's pressure to just sort of get in, look at specific sites that will be developed, and get out. And so like I say, the companies really put a pressure for First Nations to identify GPS locations. They want to know a site that's going to be avoided, as opposed to really looking at the big picture of the relationship and use of the land. And of course, if it's a mine or something like that, large-scale disruption, this avoidance like doesn't even matter. There really isn't any negotiation around it. There's also an issue of intellectual property. Most First Nations don't want their medicines and spiritual sites and grave sites put in public documents, so that there tends to be a lot of negotiation and misunderstanding from the companies and their contractors about places that First Nations want avoided because we're not tangibly proving it to them. I constantly hear elders and participants say, why are we even doing this? They're going to go ahead with it anyway. And particularly in communities like Fort Mackay that are surrounded in oil sands development, there's a sense of hopelessness and helplessness, and they say, like, this is so powerful. Why do we even bother doing these studies? Because there is a continued loss of traditional area. This is directly. There's large tracts of land being lost. People are having problems with access all of the time. Roads are fenced off. Places that people used to go, trails they can't get to anymore. And the people are really concerned about contamination. So sites that are close to Indian development, no one wants to use. No one wants to eat a moose or pick medicine or berries from a place that's close to development. And there's actually no monitoring or follow-up. So we submit these reports that go into the EIA, and then nothing, there's no system for accountability. There's no follow-up monitoring with the communities at all. So nobody really knows what happens. And so the ugly is that in the environmental impact assessments, the companies look at our reports and respond to them within the document, and they constantly say that any of the concerns that the First Nations have will have no significant impact. This is a phrase that they use over and over again, and it increases my blood pressure. So one of the big problems with this is that they'll say, well, we're removing this berry patch or this moose calving ground. However, the First Nation has a large territory where there's other places they can do that, so we have no significant impact. They're completely denying the concept of familial territories. This idea of tribes or reserves in the Treaty 8 region is a complete fallacy because people are nomadic, they still are nomadic, and they hunt and trap and harvest in familial groups. These reserves are just sort of imaginary spaces and names of reserves. It's imaginary. Everybody's interrelated. And so so when a family loses its territory where they harvest, it's lost for them. That family no longer has access to the landscape. And so there's a problem with mapping because people followed animals, migrations, and are nomadic. The maps, a static map is actually quite meaningless. People also have follow areas. They have this idea that if there's been over-harvesting an area, they're going to leave it alone and let it rest. So if a company says, are you using this area? And an elder says no, then the company says, great, we have no significant impact on this place. Like, they're not looking to the larger perspective. There's also a problem with reclamation. I don't know a single elder who's going to eat a berry or pick a medicine from a place that's been reclaimed. That land has lost its soul. There's been no offering. It's not the same place. And it's, for them, contaminated. And so finally, who funds the assessments, edits the reports, and decides if there are impacts? The company does. The company is self-regulating here. And I myself have been in situations where the companies have told me, while I'm working for the First Nation, that I have to change parts of my report because they disagree, and they're paying for the study, and so therefore they're telling me to I have to change my results, which of course I refuse to do. This just leads into my doctoral research on Cree perceptions of wild food contamination in Alberta's oil sand, with Big Stone Cree, Fort Mackay, and Mikisew Cree.